Welcome to a new episode of Product Directions Podcast, 100 Product Strategies. We are your insider access to top product leaders shaping the strategy of the most diverse industries today. I'm your host, Nacho Vassino, and I'll be digging into the real-life situations, problems, and frameworks used for strategy with product people all around the world in all kinds of products and markets. While there is no recipe for success, listening to others' experiences may give you the edge you need to solve your next strategic challenge. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode. Today, I'm really glad to be with Itamar Gilad. And Itamar has an amazing career as a product person in companies like Google and Microsoft. And in the past few years or many years, he has been helping teams become more evidence-guided. And for those of you who have worked with me, you may notice that it's one of the people I quote the most, or I include some of his tools like the confidence meter in the work I do with teams. So I'm really, really glad to have you here. Welcome to the show, Itamar.
Thank you very much, Nacho. And I really appreciate the support and the fact that you're promoting my tools to other people.
Awesome. Yeah. And most of what we will be discussing today is due to you publishing a new book. So we'll probably go into in depth into that. But before jumping into it, can you give us a few more words of introduction about yourself and what you have been doing lately?
Yeah, there's kind of three parts to my career. I started out back in the 90s as a software engineer. I gradually climbed up the ladder, but then I switched a bit to the dark side. I became a product manager, and I kept on doing this for 15 years in Israel, where I'm from. I worked in startups, I worked in scale-ups, and I worked for two large internationals, Microsoft, that was in Israel, and Google in Zurich. And Google was my last full-time gig as being a really productive person. And I worked there a bit on YouTube, but then mostly on Gmail. So some of the stuff you know in Gmail, I had a hand in doing. The good stuff only. And since 2017, I've been coaching and teaching teams what I've learned over the years. It's kind of the emphasis of my focus, as you said, is evidence-guided development.
Yeah, perfect. I think that's a good way to get right into how we can connect this to strategy, because in your book, that we'll probably explore a bit more in, or maybe we can start there. Can you give us a few words about what is your book about and why you actually felt that the world needed this book?
So when I left Google, I had all these ideas and I wanted to teach people how to work in kind of a build, measure, learn way, and much more goal-oriented, much more customer-centric. And I realized a lot of people knew the theory. A lot of people knew the ideas. They read the books. They needed tools. They needed frameworks. They needed models. So one of the key models I developed to help my clients was breaking the change, which is a really big change, honestly. It's a lot of organizations are not working this way today. We need to admit this. Into four parts: goals, ideas, steps, and tasks. Goals are about setting up good goals, about outcomes. Ideas are about prioritization. Steps are about build, measure, learn, about learning and building at the same time. And tasks are about how to work with agile teams, how to do project management that involves discovery and delivery. And more broadly, the other half of the book, which is, I think, the one you want to talk about, is how do we bring this broader into our company, this line of thinking, not just to a team or product team, but to an entire company. How do we build strategy around discovery? How do we set a mission? How do we set up goals and metrics? And how do we drive adoption? So that's the second part of my book, deals with these things.
Yeah, awesome. And I have the pleasure of being one of the early readers of the book, and I can totally recommend it. So it's a must-have for product managers out there. But we can get directly into that second part of the book, because essentially it's in this podcast.
If anyone is writing a book, I highly recommend Nacho as an early reader. He gave me tremendous feedback, really helped me a lot to improve the book.
Thank you. In this second half of the book, you introduce a fictitious company, which I think is a great approach to kind of shared ideas. And early on in that chapter, the chapter is called the Evidence Guided Company, and you early on introduced this concept of, okay, how this new company go about product strategy. Can you give us a summarized version of how a company which is evidence guided should approach strategy?
All right. This chapter specifically is constructed as a before and after. This company, yeah. Acme Invoice, is in the business of producing some sort of platform to create invoices for large organizations, for accounting firms, for banks. I chose a really hard case of B2B because I heard so many people say, no, this discovery stuff is not for large B2B. So I picked this case. And I wanted to tackle all the hard questions in this chapter. So strategy, roadmaps, big projects. So this is the chapter to where my ideas are presented about these things. And specifically for strategy, the before, and it's what I see in a lot of companies, is the strategy is a roadmap on steroids. It's just this really large plan full of really big ideas that we believe in, but are really not validated. And we just put everyone on top of it. And for the next 3 years, let's build these things. Maybe I'm exaggerating, but in large B2B, it can easily be 3 years strategy. And then we have changes in the middle and people actually realize it's going to be more expensive than we thought, or actually there's this new idea or this big customer is asking for something. So we don't really follow the strategy, but forming the strategy is really expensive. And we sit in offsites for days and weeks talking about ideas. And I think this is completely not how strategy should be. What I propose in the book is that strategy is kind of multi-level discovery process. It's a theory about that we develop over time and iterate on about how we're going to achieve our mission, how we're going to create the value we expect to create, and how we're going to create the value for ourselves that we want to create. And the process is discovering opportunities, which are areas of potential value where we can create a step function in the value we deliver and also in the value we capture. Step function or exponential growth. Yep. And then we validate these opportunities in various ways. We can go into this if you want. If we find opportunities that still show good signs that they're valid, and most are not, most don't actually work the way we expect, we can build a small kernel team around them, and that team needs to work towards product market fit. And if that works and we found product market fit, we can build a real project and a real organization around the opportunity.
Yeah, I love the approach. And one of the big questions I have in the beginning, because something that I discuss with most of my guests, is how do you actually go about uncovering these opportunities, strategic opportunities, because, and I don't want to bias your answer, but I feel that there must be a connection with the teamwork gathering evidence and this kind of high level strategic thinking to find, okay, from this evidence, what are the big opportunities that we might pursue?
So first off, you're the strategy expert, so I would love to hear your answer in more detail if we have time, but I agree with you fully. I mean, opportunities can come from anywhere. It could be a big customer that comes and asks for something, and our natural reaction is, no, it's a one-off. But if we look into it, it turns out that this is actually uncovering something we didn't think of. To give a classic example, very old one, there was Microsoft. Microsoft started out as a company that did development tools and languages, basic and stuff for microcomputers. They understood that there's going to be a big market for PCs in the world. But that was their niche. They develop software for developers mostly. And then one day they got a knock at the door and IBM showed up and said, why don't you build us an operating system? And Microsoft for the future PC, because IBM really realized they were late to the market and they wanted to rush out. And for IBM to build such a project would have taken 20 years. So they started contracting out some stuff. And Microsoft didn't believe at the time that there was a need for an operating system for PCs because Unix was deemed as the future PC operating system. Mm-hmm. They actually licensed a variant of Unix that they were selling to their customers or reselling. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden, this big customer shows up and says, why don't you build for me an entire operating system from the ground up? This is an opportunity. And I think the story goes that Bill Gates was actually against the idea, but they tried to validate it. They tried to give it a shot. They actually bought from some PhD student an operating system that he called Quick and Dirty OS, really, because it was kind of crappy. And for the next year or so, they renovated it, they improved it, and they sold this to IBM. Not for a very large sum, by the way. But this created tremendous optionality for Microsoft, because later on, all of a sudden, there was this huge market of PC clones, and they all needed an operating system. And hidden in the clause of the contract between Microsoft and IBM was a mini clause that said, we are allowed to resell this. So they rebranded it as MS-DOS, and they sold it to Compaq and Dell and basically everyone, and made an empire just based on this one opportunity.
Yeah. That's interesting, because that's I have many questions, but that leads me to one of the items I was most interested about in your approach in the book, which is the concept of the team that will go and validate the strategic opportunity. And I feel this, maybe to give a bit more context to the question, I feel this quite different from the approach in which there is the leadership deciding strategy and then throwing that strategy to the teams. Why would you, or even when would you prefer one approach or the other, if the other approach has any merit?
Just to complete the other question, sorry. Opportunities can come from everywhere. We said customer requests from the bottom. The team actually detects something. There's a new technology, you know, multi-touch came about this way, bottom up completely, or changes in the market, or a new partnership is an opportunity. There's so many. Most opportunities are actually a market segment with a need that is created, and we are stepping in. Most of the startups actually succeed because they found this sort of opportunity. So to your question, why should we validate, or when should we validate using a team? So first of all, I became acquainted with this method in Google. So not always, but there are cases where leaders came and said, you know, we think there's a potential for something here. In one example, it was to bundle a bunch of different Google products into one package and maybe sell it for a little bit of a price. But we're not sure. So they would pick up a few PMs, one from this team, another from another team, a user researcher, a data analyst. And together, as kind of a ground task force, we would go out and try to size up the market, run some interviews, run some surveys, do some stuff to create evidence either to support or refute the hypothesis behind the opportunity. And in this case, the opportunity wasn't the idea of bundling, but the opportunity was that people actually want to get all of these things together. A bundle is one idea that we could have achieved, but usually there's more than one. And what we discover in this case, for example, was that the opportunity didn't really exist there. People weren't interested to pay for the bundle, and that was good to know. So when should we do this? I think almost always, honestly, in my opinion, because we need to have a certain level of confidence in our strategy. Strategies are very risky. The decisions we make in a strategy are very important. They will affect a lot of things and will require a lot of resources. So if we come and say with confidence, we believe there's a need for this new product or this new area, and let's go and do it, I think we need to build our confidence. And I don't know of many other ways to build confidence. Sitting in a conference room and just debating usually is not enough. No. Talking to three customers is not enough.
And maybe we'll rephrase.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm rephrasing that because I kind of totally agree with that. My question goes a bit more into having a special team doing the validation versus the teams, let's say, in the ground. So the teams, so maybe I should give a bit more of context. Most companies, when they are creating a strategy, they are expanding their product, trying to capture a new niche, repositioning to grow in a certain area, things like that. So the work that they need to do will end up in some of the existing teams. Yes, there might be some hires and there might be some new teams spawning, but the main part of the work will rely on an existing workforce. So my question goes in the direction of, what about having this workforce doing the validation, even though, I mean, say, hey, this is a strategy, we are not sure, we need to gather evidence, versus forming a special team. So this is where I think, are there scenarios for each of those, or do you think that the strategy teams always should be the first step?
I think whatever works for your company is fine. I think most product teams that I meet are very tactical oriented, like they have a certain set of metrics to improve, or they're working on goals that are company level, yearly goals, etc. And when you come to them and say, also validate this opportunity, it's going to be a side activity of some of them. So it's kind of a matter of semantics, whether you split this group of people into its own little task force, or you just leave it to them to manage it in whatever way you want. I think that's less important. As long as it's done and there is validation, they are allowed to come back with even negative results and say, look, our assumptions are not being supported. That's all that matters.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think the side effect that was taken into consideration is commitment / motivation. So when what I have seen, and this is probably going into the opinionated strategy world, when you have a leader creating the strategy and throwing the strategy to a team that team doesn't believe in, even though they can collect the evidence and they can kind of start getting into it, they don't really feel it as their own. So they were not really part of the definition. And I feel that in a case, and maybe you can give me the story of Google, if you create this task force and they validate the idea, but then they need to involve more teams, the risk of those teams not really getting from the scratch the details of what you uncovered during the validation, because at the end of the day you collect evidence to support it, but you also collect evidence to make better decisions.
Yeah, I think you make a very good point. In some companies, especially like more traditional ones, there's the innovation or the incubation of the strategy is devoted to some innovation lab or innovation part. And a lot of times, okay, they develop, they create business models, they come up with something, and then they want to hand it off to the business units, and the business units are not excited at all. They didn't validate it. They don't trust it. So this sometimes is broken. I don't know if you've seen this model not working.
Probably I was kind of thinking along those lines in which the I feel that by involving the teams in this, but it's actually whatever in my book is making the assumptions that you have in your strategy very explicit so teams can go and validate first. So I think it goes along the lines of pushing the teams to know that there is a space there to refute the strategy or to gather more evidence around it.
Totally. And the example I gave, for example, is that they picked us product managers because they knew that if we eventually will decide to follow the strategy, we will be also the people driving it forward. And the people we would pull in, the data scientists, the engineers, etc., to help validate are the people that eventually will be involved in the project. So I think that's a key point that you are correct about. Don't just throw it off to some random team for validation, then move it to another team to pick up. It's better if it's the same people and there's continuity.
Yeah, love it. One thing that from the last section that you were mentioning about finding these opportunities, I didn't ask about, is your definition about opportunities. But I don't need a formal definition, but maybe to make it a bit more complete, in your framework, you use the concept ideas most often. So falling more into that, we'll call it the solution category, versus in this area of a strategy, talking more about opportunities. How do you feel about the difference between those two, and or maybe why you use ideas in the GIST framework versus opportunities, I don't know, like the opportunity solution tree or something like that?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. It's also a bit compounded because now opportunities are sometimes used to denote customer problems. Like if you read books like Continuous Discovery Habits by Teresa Torres, there she uses the word opportunity to mean what we used to call underserved user needs or customer problems. And I think when we say strategic opportunities, at least I mean something a little bit different. It's like this potential of big value creation. So maybe the best is, again, using an example. I'm sorry, most of my examples are very famous, so it's easier to relate. take early Google, for example. It had search, it had advertising, it created its core business, very successful, and they needed to expand. And they looked for adjacent opportunities, essentially, even if they didn't use this term. And one of them was video. It was pretty obvious that people are going to search for videos, and that's going to constitute a large amount of search. It's going to be a problem of data gathering and organization, which is exactly what the mission of Google is about. So that seems completely strategic and important for Google. So the opportunity, I think, was validated. It was clear to them they need to do something about video. The solutions, or the ideas, as I call them, but they are solutions. The first solution wasn't very successful. They launched something called Google Video, which was their own attempt to allow people to upload and manage and publish videos. And because it's social and because it's Google, it failed. Google just historically doesn't do social. I don't know why, but it's karma. Really hard for them. And they realized this. It was one of the apps that failed. And the person in charge of this, Salah, was a very famous one of the early Googlers, one of the inventors of AdSense, by the way, super smart guy. He came back to the management of Google and said, we need to capture the opportunity, but here's idea number two. Let's buy a startup that already knows how to do this properly. So they looked around. The most successful startup was in San Bruno, a company called YouTube. And that's history. They bought it for $1.1 billion, which back then was amazing. No one heard of such numbers. And YouTube became a core part of Google. And today we cannot think about Google without YouTube. It's very clear. Yeah. So same opportunity, two ideas, one failed, one succeeded. For me, this is strategy. This is how you do it.
Yeah, I love that. Then going back to collecting these strategic opportunities, and maybe, again, I'm referring back to the book because that's the where you explain the framework, but for the ideas part, you have pretty strong, I would say, artifacts, but ways of handling this idea collection and idea processing. For strategic opportunities, do you have similar thoughts or feelings? Do you have, maybe with companies you coach or companies you work with, do you have a way for them to collect those ideas?
The ideas or the opportunities?
No, sorry, the opportunities. So to collect the opportunities in this case.
Yeah, and by the way, after that, you need to start creating ideas as well. You need to set a goal. If sure. you validate an opportunity and you say, look, we found something people really need, you can create a goal and then collect ideas and then start using GIST, the way I describe it. With idea banks and ICE and confidence scores and all this good stuff. We'll not go into all of this now. I assume that we don't have the time. For collecting the opportunities, I think, in my perspective, but that's process. This can be very different for any different company. It can be collected by the CPO or by some director of product whose job is to, among other things, look for opportunities. Help develop the strategy by collecting them. And I think the message should be, if you see an opportunity, come to that person. It's really important. Just flow them up and let that person collect them. And then that person will review them with the management team, with the leadership team, and they will decide which opportunities they want to validate first, and which it's a very important discussion to have on an ongoing basis. And if you look at companies, strategic companies like Amazon or Facebook, that's essentially what they were doing. They were constantly on the lookout for what might come next and always looking for these good opportunities, not just specific ideas, but opportunities. Another option is to also do a bottom-up approach. So you allow each team, you give them some budget to do some far-reaching stuff. Mm-hmm. And this might be, usually they will talk in language of ideas. They will come up with some idea and spend 20% on developing it. But that's a way to uncover opportunities sometimes. Because sometimes they just find a new technology and they just want to mess with it and see what they can do. And that uncovers an opportunity. So that's another way to validate or to create opportunities. And I'm sure there are more, like you probably can name another five, but these are two that I've seen working.
Yeah, I love those. I love those. And I think that it goes back to, at the end of the day, you want to have many opportunities and then you want to collect evidence to see which is the strongest one. But to begin with, as easier you make the process for surfacing these opportunities, the more you can collect and the more you can eventually select on. Okay, I will switch gears a bit more on this, make it a bit from a strategy to the sheets framework, because when you have a strategy, you want to define goals, what we are trying to achieve. So the way, maybe, I'm not sure if taking from the strategy chapter, from the goals chapter, but how do you go about saying, okay, this is the big opportunity we're trying to pursue, how do we tie that to goals, then to jump into teams?
All right, so... First off, goals can start even earlier. A goal might be, let's find opportunities to grow by 20%, or let's discover the next version of ourselves. Or, and that could be a valid goal for a company. It's not very specific. It's a little bit harder to measure, but it's something that's good to put in company goals, especially when the company feels like it's too exposed because it's invested in only one area, just the core. If you found an opportunity, you've done the business modeling, you've done the market sizing, you interviewed, you've done some validation, you think it's good, and you want to create now some work around it, the early goal, I would say, is find product market fit. And that's basically the same goal I would recommend to a startup when they're starting, because a startup is trying to find an opportunity and capture it, right? Yeah. And that's basically the first thing they do. So
how do you measure that? If you want to kind of put that type of goal, what actually will you measure, or some example of what you will measure to measure if you get product market fit?
All right. So if it's an OKR, I would say the objective is, let's find product market fit in this opportunity. And the key results are, what would be the customer behaviors that we would expect that will indicate to us that we have found product market fit. So you could use the Sean Allis survey, and like, if you have enough customers, you run a survey at the end, or enough users, and they say 40% at least would say, I'll be very disappointed if you take it away from me. That kind of requires, that's more B2C, I would say. If it's B2B, you would say, for us, finding product market fit is getting eight companies to, let's say 20 to sign up to a wait list to join the early adopter program. At least 10 are joining, or 8. And out of the 8, 6 are willing to buy. Like, we got them to the point where they're willing to buy. That's it's a long goal. That's a year plus, sometimes more. But that's an indication of product market fit. By the way, there's chapter 7, I think, where you can find example goals like this for startups, for larger organizations. So it's basically reusing the startup playbook. Find product market fit, find these indications that you have found product market fit without cheating. And these are hard things to do. I mean, getting six out of eight to convert and to be willing to buy, that's not easy in B2B. And then after you found product market fit, you can start developing your business model and expanding the team and switching to growth. And again, this is the scale-up playbook.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm wondering if there is a difference between the goals, not even the goals, but maybe it's on the steps side of... let's go into the steps part of strategy. If you are trying to validate strategy in this, let's go back to the teamwork. It's they have a goal, they have an opportunity they're trying to pursue, and they try to validate. Is the validation of opportunities different from the validation of ideas in the kind of more granular part of the framework?
So in chapter 4, steps, just for those people who are not familiar, step for me is like... a generic term for an activity that teaches us something about the idea and often also develops it a little bit. So it could be a business model. It could be writing some numbers on a funnel and seeing, projecting how many people will get, how many conversions. It could be interviewing an expert. It could be doing interviewing customers, observing them. It could be running a fake door test. It could be any number of things, up to an A-B experiment and full launch and betas and dog foods. I give 28 examples of these methods. So each one of those is a step. At the end of the step, we usually have a slightly more evolved version of the idea, and also some more evidence whether or not it's going to do what we expect. So validating opportunities at the early stage, it's really hard to build stuff and actually measure the opportunity, because to build, first you need to have an idea of what you're building. So what I recommend usually is to start from doing a business model canvas, like strategizers, doing a lot of interviews, doing surveys, doing data analysis, if you have access to the data that will support or refute the opportunity. And then you can start modeling how it might look and have a few, after you have a few business model canvases, because you always need to create more than one. You can go to potential customers, show them, I don't know, mockups or just something to visualize the idea and kind of interview them of what they think about this and whether or not they would find value in this. And I'm sure if someone is creative, they can push it even further. They can start mocking up, but it's going deeper and deeper into idea territory rather than opportunity territory. Yeah. Usually it's enough if you have a business model that looks good on paper, enough customer evidence for interviews or data for you to come back to the executive team and say, looks like there's something here. And, oh, competitive analysis is also a good one.
Good point. Yeah, so my summary of it is like it's more about the demand validation and the side of how big this problem and this pain could be, rather than starting with the solutions. I wonder, when you are helping teams, when are they starting with ideating solutions? And if you recommend any technique to consider multiple solutions, multiple options, as you said before in the YouTube case. Is there a systematic approach you recommend to that, or is more like each team goes in a different way?
So I really like qualitative research, and I think the book we mentioned by Teresa is a really good one for this. I like also quantitative research. If you can look at your data and do deep dives, I learn a lot by just digging into Gmail data and seeing patterns and learning from that. And any way you can expose yourself to customers and to observe them, or if you just go to a conference where they go and you have a few chats with them, ideas will come for opportunities. Well, you will start seeing patterns. Also, if you see a cluster of your competitors starting to try to solve a certain problem, trying to attack a certain market segment, that might be an indication. Another source is technology. I mean, now we're having this huge, massive wave of generative machine learning. And I think every company in the world now needs to think, is this an opportunity for us? What can we do with this technology? And here often the validation is to let the engineers play with it and come up with something. I mentioned before that the origin of the iPhone, one of the sources of the iPhone was the fact that a clandestine team of designers and engineers inside Apple started playing with early multi-touch until they got to a point where they gave Steve Jobs a demo on PC, by the way, on a Mac. And initially he hated it, but then he liked it, and that turned into a huge opportunity, because here was this technology that was potentially revolutionary. It was just a question of which device do we put it in. Initially they tried to put it in a tablet, but they realized it's going to be way too expensive, so they killed it. But then through different iterations of the idea of a phone, they ended up with a multi-touch phone, which turned out to be this remarkable device.
Yeah, that could be huge. It's interesting because, and going back to what you were saying, so ideas can, or opportunities can come from anywhere. And in this scenario, this little team playing with some technology will not only find a solution or an idea for their goals or whatever, it's kind of can scale much higher through finding the right opportunity.
Yeah. I can give you another classic example from Netflix, for example, if we have the time, because they really did something quite remarkable. If you follow the writings of Gibson Biddle, he explains this. So back in the mid-2000s, I think, they had their core business of DVD by mail service, but they realized it needs to go to the internet. They needed to do something with the internet. There was a huge opportunity there, but they didn't want to lock themselves into a specific idea. Because initially, for example, the most intuitive idea, and I can tell you because I worked in a startup who did this, was to download the videos to the customer storage. But they didn't want to call it that. They didn't want to say, let's build a download service. They called it instant gratification or instant, and they created a team, which they call swim lanes, to figure out what's the best instant gratification kind of solution there is. And this team explored downloads, but also explored streaming and the capability of the technology. And they had to project how much bandwidth and how much cost it will be to stream. And eventually they came back and they said, we think streaming is the solution. They had another team to figure out what's the business model. And that team explored advertising and explored pay-per-view. Also explored all you can eat for $10, and that turned out to be the best idea for this model. So they took this big opportunity, they carved it into different aspects of it, and in each one they built a swim lane, a team, to iterate and find what's the optimal solution. And I think that's a beautiful model for doing a really big strategic initiative. And I think the success of Netflix streaming is an indication of how well this worked for them.
At the end of the day, you start with goals in the GIST framework, and then you go to ideas, but ideas are somehow related to opportunities. I mean, if we kind of come from the strategy discussion that we were having, we have these big opportunities, but at the end of the day, you are, or after you validate that the opportunity or the size of the bet is good enough, you will come up with multiple ideas and start validating each. So that's a good connection between the words.
Exactly.
Yeah. Great.
By the way, if you're lucky, sometimes you start from the idea, maybe idea number one doesn't turn out to be the best, but then you discover an opportunity and that leads to idea number two. That's a story I also tell, by the way, in the book, in chapter number one, how we launched the tabbed inbox. Started from why, it's not super strategic, but it was a big change for Google. Started from my idea, which wasn't very good, but with the help of my team, we actually uncovered a big need. And that turned into a better idea. So again, this is a story I'm sharing in the book.
Okay, changing gears a bit, going back into the Sheets framework. I'm wondering more, and going off track with strategy, what is the part of the framework that you or teams find more difficult to implement, or that you find them struggling the most?
What is the hardest part? Good. I would give you two. One is leaders find it very hard to express the goals in terms of outcomes instead of here's what we want to build. Are we talking general gist or just strategy-wise?
No, general, yeah.
All right, so telling leaders, stop telling everyone what to do in the goals, and just tell them what to achieve is an adjustment. We both were in this seat, so you can imagine it's hard for them because they're responsible at the end of the day. If the team messes up, they prefer to tell the team exactly what to do because they feel it improves the odds of success, although it doesn't. For teams, however, it's really hard to tell them stop focusing on delivery and also work on discovery. A lot of teams, especially here in Europe, were trained that their job is to burn through story points and to deliver small increments of code into production and to move tickets to the done state. And the more they do this, the better. So you need to come and reprogram them and say, you know, we need also to experiment and learn and sometimes throw away some code, and that's perfectly fine. So I think these are the two toughest parts of this exercise.
By the way, you have a beautiful article I read not long ago, but probably it's a bit older, in which you compare kind of two teams, and one that is not doing discoveries or failing out of time, but trying to go faster and still not producing enough impact, versus another one that tends to go slower for doing more discovery, but having a better average hit rate in terms of the initiatives that have success. So I think it's a nice way to frame it.
Yeah, and in this article, it's a thought exercise, but I think it's realistic. The team that quote unquote goes slower but does more discovery is able to create 10x the value of the fast team. And the fast team is slowing down over time because they're pushing out so many changes that their code is becoming more and more cumbersome. And in general, we need to move away from the concept of fast or velocity is about pushing code, and it's much more about time to outcomes. That's really what we want to optimize for. So,
continuing the thought exercise. I mean, I know you have written the book to enlighten other ones, but why do you feel these concepts are still so hard to grasp by teams?
Partly because they are incentivized to not grasp them. If you got promoted on launching a big project and you got promoted again, and now you're a manager and you're teaching other people and you've never seen anything else, when someone with a strange accent shows up and says, focus on outcomes, it's like, yeah, but not in my company. It's not, this is for Silicon Valley, but not for us. We have a different way of doing things. If you're an entrepreneur and all your investors are like pushing you, launch, run like hell, it's really hard to adopt a different model. And I think there's a dissonance. Like people read the Marty Kagan's books or even Teresa Torres' books, and they're like, I would love to work like this way, but it's completely irrelevant to my world. So I will put this aside as an ideal world, and I'll keep on doing what I did until now and be a little bit frustrated maybe, but what can you do? And I don't think that's the case. I think you can drive the change. All of these books are very realistic, and you can actually make a change, in at least in your area of responsibility. We just need to embrace the journey, because it's not going to be easy.
All right. This has been wonderful, Itamar. Thanks so much for all the wisdom you share with us. So let's start easy. Where can people find the book that they really must read?
Oh, first, thank you. If you go to evidenceguided, just one word, .com, you'll find a book and a link to where you can buy it. And if you're interested in any of the topics we talked about in general, go to itamargilad.com/resources, and you can download some of the stuff. I have templates, I have spreadsheets and stuff that you can download and play with.
That's perfect. Anything else you want to say to the audience, or any other way that they might help you?
Just one thing about strategy we didn't mention. What we talked about is strategy discovery, but strategy is a much larger topic. As you know, there's also principles, there's also guidelines, there's all sorts of things we didn't cover. So strategy is not easy. As you know, it's a slow process. It takes a lot of time and a lot of iteration. So be patient. If you're working on strategy, be patient and persistent, and you'll get there.
Great. Awesome. Well, thanks so much for joining us today.
For sure. Thank you for inviting me.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of 100 Product Strategies, the podcast by Product Direction. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, or Instagram to get access to free weekly content that helps product people upgrade their skills and become more successful. You can access more material, promotional trainings, and be notified of every episode of the show with Product Direction's weekly newsletter. Join thousands of product leaders by registering in productdirection.co.